Follow the news wherever you go. Check out our Twitter feed at CBS Radio News for hourly headlines and breaking news. And join the conversation by liking us on Facebook.
If there's a face of the failures in treating mental illness, it may be Senator Cree Deeds. His scars are from a knife wielded by his own son.
He had determined that I had to die, that I was an evil man, that he was going to execute me, and then he was going to go straight to heaven.
Like Deeds, thousands of parents have nowhere to bring their children in crisis but the emergency room.
We have 52 psychiatric beds here at Yale, and right now all 52 are full.
That's the apartment.
That corner on the third floor.
The apartment belonged to Boston mobster and longtime fugitive Whitey Bulger, then the most wanted man in America. Bulger eluded the FBI for 14 years by hiding in plain sight in Santa Monica, California. Tonight, you'll hear from the agents who finally caught him with some help from an alley cat and his girlfriend's breast implants.
We just rushed him.
Mimi, guns out, FBI, sure. Don't move.
I asked him to identify himself, and that didn't go over well. He asked me to effing identify myself, and I asked him, I said, are you Whitey Bulger? He said yes.
Nick Saban runs the gold standard of college football programs. He's been disciplined and demanding on his way to 3 national championships in 5 years.
I want you to step, step, step. Do it again. Bring it back. Do it again. I've told you 3 times already today.
We create a standard for how we want to do things. And everybody's got to buy into that standard, or you really can't have any team chemistry. You know, mediocre people don't like high achievers, and high achievers don't like mediocre people.
And as we found out, Saban's standards are no different for young football campers.
Shake hands. Come on, man. Shake hands. Good job, man.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes. Last November 19th, Virginia State Senator Cree Deeds was slashed and stabbed repeatedly by his own son. Gus Deeds was 24 years old and had been struggling with mental illness. He and his father had been in an emergency room just hours before the attack, but they didn't get the help that they needed. The story of what went wrong with his medical care exposes a problem in the way that America handles mental health. It's a failure that came to the fore with the murders at Sandy Hook Elementary School. The vast majority of mental patients are not violent, but this is a story about the fraction who are a danger to themselves or others. As we first reported in January, parents of mentally ill children in crisis often find, as Senator Deeds did, that they have nowhere to go. Cree Deeds bears the scars of this failure on his face, his body, and his soul.
I really don't want Gus to be defined by his illness. I don't want Gus to be defined by what happened on the 19th. Gus was a great kid. He was a perfect son. It's clear the system failed. It's clear that failed Gus. It killed Gus.
We met Cree Deeds 4 weeks after the attack. He was still distraught, but he told us his story was a warning that could not wait.
What would have saved Gus?
If he could have been hospitalized that night, they could have gotten him medicated, and I could have worked to get Gus in some sort of long-term care.
This is Gus Deeds when he was 20 years old, a talented musician on the dean's list at the College of William and Mary.
Gus, when he turned 20, I was running for governor. He wanted to come, and so he took this fall of 2009 off to be with me. Those are some of the best memories of my life, is having him with me there.
But after the campaign, for no reason anyone could see, Gus Deeds stopped taking care of himself and became paranoid, obsessive, antisocial. He dropped out and couldn't keep a job. In 2011, he was diagnosed as bipolar. His father was so worried that Gus would kill himself, Deeds told us he got rid of all of the guns in their rural farmhouse except one hunting rifle that had no ammunition. Later, with medication, Gus returned to William and Mary, until last fall.
Gus had posted weird things on his Facebook page about, how the professors were ganging up against him. And he was going to start boycotting class. It was pretty clear to me that he wasn't taking medicine. I told Gus that he and I needed to talk to somebody together.
That's when Deeds discovered that talking to somebody, getting treatment, is harder in mental health than any other kind of medicine. In the decades after the 1960s, most large mental institutions were closed. It was thought that patients would get better treatment back in their communities. But adequate local facilities were never built. The number of beds available to psychiatric patients in America dropped from more than 500,000 to fewer than 100,000. That leaves many kids in crisis today with one option, the emergency room.
You know, every day we have 10 to 20 kids with psychiatric problems come into our emergency department. Kids who want to kill themselves, who've tried to kill themselves, who've tried to kill somebody else.
Brian Geiser is a nurse practitioner we met in the emergency department of Yale New Haven Hospital in Connecticut. It's one of the best in the nation in psychiatry.
Well, we have 52 psychiatric beds here at Yale, and right now all 52 are full. And so the 7 kids that are here in the emergency room are waiting for an open bed.
How long will they wait?
5 of them have been here 3 days already.
Most every day, the beds are full of patients in crisis. 17-year-old Tyler Ridington was waiting in the ER. He had just slashed his face with a knife.
You hear voices?
Yes. A new voice came about a year ago, and I call it a he, because it was more of a deeper voice, but he ended up telling me to hurt myself and making me find ways to hurt myself.
Do the voices ever tell you to hurt someone else?
Only once, and that was at school, and that was when I got admitted into the hospital, because I was actually considering hurting the people around me. And I was like, this ain't me. This is not what I want to do.
Tyler's dad, Ernie Ridington, had called a psychiatrist that week, but couldn't get an appointment for 3 months. There's a national shortage of psychiatrists.
Why is there not another option for you?
This has always been our only option.
The emergency room.
The emergency room, yeah. Because we know that when we come here, they take the time to take care of him. They sit and watch him, make sure he's okay.
But okay usually means okay for the moment. Typically, insurance companies pay for this care only as long as the patients are, quote, at imminent risk of harming themselves or others.
Some insurance companies will give us a couple of days, a few days, before they ask us to call them back to get reauthorization for the admission. Some of them are every single day that we have to call. And so usually, you know, we're talking about, you know, 3 to 4 days, and the insurance companies are saying, all right, you know, it's time. Let's get this kid out.
Because they're not going to kill themselves or someone else right now.
Right now, yeah.
Many patients need care for months or years, but there are few facilities of that kind. They're expensive, and often insurance won't cover them. So kids in crisis spin in the emergency room's revolving door.
We need to be able to set up a system where we follow these kids into the community. We follow the families. We make sure that they have a safety net and somebody's watching them and monitoring them. Because, you know, it could be next month, it could be 6 months from now, and the child will do something again. But if they're not hooked into a system that's watching them, taking care of them, then we could have problems on our hands.
How many of you have had to take your child to the emergency room? Everybody. And how many times?
I can't count. I couldn't count.
7 Connecticut mothers, including Mary Jo Andrews, Meg Clancy, and Dee Orsi, told us about their ER crises and battles over insurance.
My daughter, after spending, she was 8 at the time, spending 12 days in the hospital, they told me she was ready to come home. By Friday morning, we were in the psychiatrist's office for her follow-up appointment. She was seeing blood dripping from the walls. There was statues telling her to kill me. And she was ready for discharge 3 days earlier.
We had one with an insurance company. They wanted to discharge my daughter.
she needed to stay where she was safe. And the insurance company would not pay for her to stay. And so I was told by our social worker in the hospital that if I gave my daughter up to Department of Children and Families, that then she would have insurance coverage through the state and she would be allowed to stay.
Wait a minute. Give
her up.
Give her up to the state?
Correct. Give her up to the state.
And you said what?
Absolutely not.
They formed this support group because so few people understand their troubles. For example, they share the names of contractors to repair walls or remove doors. Their children punch holes in the drywall and can't be allowed to lock themselves in a room.
What is the difference between being the mother of a child who has mental illness and the mother of a child who might have heart disease or cancer?
Sympathy.
Being in Connecticut, they watched the tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary with more insight than most. Referring to the killer's mother, one of them told us, if Nancy Lanza had a health care plan for her son, she couldn't have made it work.
There's really no place after the hospital, so the kids end up coming back home, right where the situation started. And, you know, the psychiatrists in the hospital will say, you're right, the system's broken. And I remember at one discharge, I refused to sign the discharge paper because I wasn't going to agree that it was appropriate.
They discharged your child anyway.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes.
That is essentially what happened to Cree Deeds in Virginia last November. But his effort was further complicated by the fact that his son, Gus, was an adult, over 18, and Gus didn't want treatment. Deeds had to get a court order and sheriff's deputies to take Gus to the ER. A state law designed to protect patients' rights meant that the court order would expire in only 6 hours. That's all they had to find a hospital that would admit him.
Whole afternoon, Gus didn't sit down. He paced the floor. He'd look at me. He'd smile. And I just had this sinking feeling that he wasn't going to be hospitalized.
And if you didn't find a hospital bed in 6 hours, Gus was coming home.
He was coming home. And I was concerned that if he came home, there was going to be a crisis.
A representative of the county agency that manages mental health care told Deeds that he couldn't find a hospital with a psychiatric bed appropriate for Gus's case.
You're concerned that your son is suicidal. The clock has run out on the emergency room, and he comes in and says, sorry, you've got to leave?
He said that Gus wasn't suicidal. I guess he'd made
based
that evaluation.
Based on his evaluation.
His evaluation that Gus wasn't suicidal.
What did you say to him in leaving the emergency room?
I said, the system failed my son tonight.
There was no place to go but home.
And he sat at one end of the dining room table. I sat at the other end. I ate my food, and he just was writing furiously in this journal he kept. Not much conversation. And I said, good night, bud. I didn't know what was going to happen. But the next morning, you know, I felt like there'd be a confrontation, but I had no reason to think there'd be violence. But you know, I got ready for work, and I went out to the barn to feed the horses. And Gus was coming across the yard, and I said, hey, bud, how'd you sleep? He said, fine. I turned my back, and, you know, had this feed thing in my hands, and he was just on me.
He attacked you?
He got me twice, you know, stabbed me twice.
With a knife?
The state police told me they found a knife. And I turned around and said, bud, what's going on? I said, and he just kept coming at me. I said, Gus, I love you so much. I said, don't make this any worse than it is. He just kept coming at me. And he just kept, I mean, you know, I was bleeding a good bit. But, you know, he turned around and he started walking toward the house.
Deeds staggered away. A neighbor found him. A helicopter ambulance was called.
Well, that was in the rescue squad or the helicopter somewhere. I'd heard about some call came over the scanner that there'd been somebody with a gunshot wound to the head.
The gunshot victim was Gus.
Oh, yeah.
Gus had killed himself. He had found or bought ammunition for that last rifle, the unloaded rifle that Deeds had kept in the house.
You were describing the last night in which he was writing feverishly in this notebook before you said goodnight. Did you go back and look at that?
I did.
What was he writing?
He had determined that I had to die, that I was an evil man, that he was going to execute me, and then he was going to go straight to heaven.
You've told us in this interview again and again that you don't want Gus to be defined by what happened in those few seconds.
Right. I want people to remember the brilliant, friendly, loving kid that was Gus Deeds. We'll use Gus, I hope, to address mental health and to make sure that other people don't have to suffer through this.
Cree Deeds returned to the state Senate last January with four new pieces of legislation aimed at reforming mental health care in Virginia. Thanks to his work, state evaluators now have 8 hours instead of six to find a bed in a mental health facility for a patient in crisis. There's now a real-time online registry of empty beds and a requirement that if time runs out, patients like Gus Deeds can be sent to a state hospital instead of being sent home.
Charlie and Carol Gasco were an elderly couple who moved to Santa Monica, California, sometime in early 1997 to begin a new phase of their life. For the next 14 years, they did almost nothing that was memorable. And as we first reported in November, they would be of absolutely no interest if it weren't for the fact that Charlie Gasco turned out to be James Whitey Bulger, the notorious Boston gangster and longtime fugitive who is now in prison serving two lifetime sentences. Carol Gasco was actually Catherine Gregg, Whitey's longtime girlfriend and caregiver. The story of how they managed to elude an international manhunt for so long while hiding in plain sight is interesting. And tonight you'll hear it from the Gasco's neighbors and from the federal agents who finally unraveled the case with the help of a boob job and an alley cat.
If you're forced into retirement with a comfortable nest egg and a desire to be left completely alone, there is no better place than Santa Monica, California. This low-key, seaside suburb of L.A. is shared by transients and tourists, hippies and hedonists, celebrities, and lots of senior citizens, attracted to the climate and an abundance of inexpensive, rent-controlled apartments just a few blocks from the ocean. Places like the Princess Eugenia on 3rd Street, which is where Charlie and Carol Gasco, a childless couple from Chicago, lived for 14 years without attracting much attention from longtime neighbors or landlords. Josh Bond is the building manager.
What were they like?
They were like the nice, retired old couple that lived in the apartment next to me.
Good tenants?
Excellent tenants. Never complained. Always paid rent on time.
In cash?
In cash.
Janice Goodwin lived down the hall.
They had nothing, and they never went out. They'd never had food delivered. She never dressed nicely.
You thought they were poor?
Yes, without a doubt.
The one thing everyone remembers about the Gascos is that they loved animals and always made a fuss over the ones in the neighborhood. Barbara Gluck remembers that Carol Gasco always fed a stray cat after its owner had died.
She would, you know, pet it and be sweet to it, and then she would put a plate of food, like, out here. Mm-hmm.
And what about Charlie Gasco?
You know, he always had a hat on and dark glasses. I have to say, it was mysterious to me why a lovely woman like that was hanging out with that guy, that old grumpy man. I never could figure that one out until I heard they had $800,000-something in the wall. And then I went, oh, okay, you know.
Money wasn't the only thing found in the Gasco's apartment on June 22, 2011, when the FBI stopped by and ended what it called the most extensive manhunt in the Bureau's history.
Weapons all over the apartment. I mean, weapons by his nightstand, weapons under the windowsill, shotguns, mini Rugers, rifles.
Loaded.
Loaded, ready to go.
What had started out as a routine day for Special Agent Scott Gariola, who was in charge of hunting fugitives in L.A., would turn into one of the most interesting days of his career. After getting a call to stake out a building in Santa Monica, he notified his backup team with the LAPD.
I had four guys working that day, and they said, we got a tip on Whitey Bulger, and I'll see you there in about an hour. And invariably, the text will return, who's Whitey Bulger?
Really?
A few of them. So I'd remind him, gently remind him, who Whitey Bulger was.
That he was number one on the FBI's most wanted list.
Number one. Number one, yeah. Big East Coast figure, but in the West Coast, not so much.
Mention any cartel leader.
The cops in L.A. were focused on gangbangers and cartel members, not some retired Irish mobster who hadn't been spotted in 16 years. But then few mobsters have ever been as infamous in a city as Whitey Bulger was in Boston, and his reputation was for more than just being grumpy. Besides extortion and flooding the city with cocaine, Bulger routinely performed or ordered executions, some at close range, some with a hail of bullets, and at least one by strangulation, after which it's said he took a nap. Special Agent Rich Tian, who ran the FBI's Whitey Bulger Fugitive Task Force, had heard it all.
Bulger was charged with 19 counts of murder. He was charged with other crimes. He was a scourge to the society in South Boston, his own community.
He was also a scourge to the FBI and a great source of embarrassment to Tian, Special Agent Phil Torsney, and others on the FBI task force. Years earlier, Whitey Bulger had infiltrated the Boston office of the FBI and bought off agents who protected him and plied him with information, including the tip that allowed Bulger to flee just days before he was to be indicted.
We really had to catch this guy to establish credibility after all the other issues, and it was just a matter of bringing this guy back to Boston.
Torsney, who's now retired, and Agent Tommy McDonald joined the task force in 2009. The joke was Bulger was on the FBI's least wanted list. There hadn't been a credible lead in more than a decade, and their efforts in Bulger's old neighborhood of South Boston were met with mistrust and ridicule.
Some people, they told us right out front, you guys aren't looking for that guy. People just made the assumption we had him stashed somewhere. I mean, people really thought that kind of thing.
Despite that mindset that we're not going to help you, the FBI still got it done.
Took 16 years.
Took 16 years. Yeah, this was not a typical fugitive.
The FBI says Bulger had planned his getaway years in advance, with money set aside and a fake identity for a Thomas Baxter. During his first 2 years on the lam, Bulger was in touch with friends and family, shuttling between New York, Chicago, and the resort town of Grand Isle, Louisiana, where he rented a home until his identity was compromised. After that, it seemed as if Bulger had disappeared from the face of the earth, except for the alleged sightings all over the world.
How many of these tips do you think might have been true?
Boy, there was thousands and thousands of tips, and I think, I don't think any of them were true.
One of the obstacles was there were really no good photographs of Bulger or his longtime live-in girlfriend, Catherine Gregg, a former dental hygienist. The FBI often noted that the couple shared a love of animals, especially dogs and cats, and asked veterinarians to be on the lookout. There were reports that Gregg once had breast implants and other plastic surgery in Boston, so the task force reached out to physicians. Eventually, they got a call from a Dr. Matthias Donnellan, who had located her files in storage.
I was trying to leave the office a little early to catch one of my kids' ball games, and I said, well, listen, I'm going to swing by in the morning and pick those up. And they said to me, do you want the photos, too? And I said, you have photos? And they said, yeah, we have photos. And I said, we'll be there in 15 minutes.
The breast implant lead produced a treasure trove of high-resolution Catherine Gregg photographs that would help crack the case. The FBI decided to switch strategies, going after the girlfriend in order to catch the gangster.
This is an announcement by the FBI.
The FBI created this public service announcement.
60-year-old Grieg is the girlfriend of 81-year-old Bulger.
It ran in 14 markets on daytime talk shows aimed at women.
Call the tip line at 1-800-CALL-FBI.
And it didn't take long. The very next morning, the Bulger task force got three messages from someone that used to live in Santa Monica and was 100% certain that Charlie and Carol Gasco, apartment 303 at the Princess Eugenia Apartments, were the people they were looking for. The descriptions and the age difference matched, and Deputy U.S. Marshal Neil Sullivan, who handled the lead, said there was another piece of tantalizing information.
The tipster specifically described that they were caring for this cat and their love for this cat. So that was just one piece of the puzzle and the tip that just added up to saying, if this isn't them, it's something we better check out immediately because it sure sounds like them.
A search of the FBI's computer database for the Gascos raised another red flag, not for what it found, but for what it didn't.
basically like they were ghosts.
No driver's license.
Exactly. No driver's license, no California ID, like they didn't exist.
That's the apartment.
That corner on the third floor.
On the right-hand side?
Yep.
By early afternoon, FBI agent Scott Gariola had set up a number of surveillance posts and had already met with apartment manager Josh Bond to talk about his tenants.
He closed the door, threw down a folder and opened it up and said, are these the people that live in apartment 303?
Did you say anything when you saw the pictures?
My initial reaction was, holy
You're living next door to a gangster.
Well, I still didn't really know who he was.
But it didn't take him long to figure it out. While the FBI was mulling its options, Bond logged on to Bulger's Wikipedia page.
I'm just kind of scrolling down. It's like, oh, wow, this guy's serious. It's like murders and extortion. And then I get to the bottom, and there's this thing. It's like from one of his old people saying, well, the last time I saw him, he said, you know, when he goes out, he's going to have guns, and he's going to be ready to take people with him. I was like, ooh, maybe I shouldn't be involved in this.
I mean, we were sitting here laughing about it, but he's a pretty serious guy.
Yeah.
He killed a lot of people.
True.
Or had them killed.
I didn't know that at the time.
Bond told the FBI he wasn't going to knock on the Gasco's door because there was a note posted expressly asking people not to bother them. Carol had told neighbors that Charlie was showing signs of dementia.
So we were back there.
So Gariola devised a ruse involving the Gasco's storage locker in the garage.
It had the name Gasco across it, and apartment 303.
He had the manager called to tell them that their locker had been broken into and that he needed someone to come down to see if anything was missing. Carol Gasco said her husband would be right down.
We just rushed him.
Mimi, guns out, FBI,
sure.
Don't move.
Gave the words, hey, FBI, get your hands up. And hands went up right away. And then at that moment, we told him to get down on his knees, and he gave us, I ain't getting down on my effing knees.
Didn't want to get his pants dirty.
Didn't want to get his pants dirty. You know, wearing white and seeing the oil on the ground, I guess he didn't want to get down in oil.
Even at 81, this was a man used to being in control.
I asked him to identify himself, and that didn't go over well. He asked me to effing identify myself, which I did. And I asked him, I said, are you Whitey Bulger? He said, yes. Just about that moment, someone catches my attention from a few feet away by the elevator shaft.
It was Janice Goodwin from the third floor coming to do her laundry.
And I said, excuse me, I think I can help you. This man has dementia, so if he's acting oddly, you know, that could be why.
Immediately what flashed through my mind is, oh, my God, I just arrested an 81-year-old man with Alzheimer's who thinks he's Whitey Bulger. What is he going to tell me next? He's Elvis? So I said, do me a favor. I said, this woman over here says you have a touch of Alzheimer's. He said, don't listen to her. She's effing nuts. He says, I'm James Bulger.
A few minutes later, he confirmed it, signing a consent form allowing the FBI to search his apartment.
As he's signing, he says, that's the first time I've signed that name in a long time.
Was there a feeling of resignation?
I don't think he had it. I did ask him. I said, hey, Whitey, I said, aren't you relieved that you don't have to look over your shoulder anymore and you know, it's come to an end? And he said, are you nuts?
But in some ways, Whitey Bulger and Catherine Gregg had already been prisoners in apartment 303, which appeared to be a mixture of the murderous and the mundane. Alongside the weapons and all the money, they had stockpiled a lifetime supply of cleansers, creams, and detergents. The FBI took special interest in a collection of 64-ounce bottles with white socks stretched over the top.
I said, hey, Whitey, what are these? Are these some kind of Molotov cocktail you're making? He goes, no. He said, I buy tube socks from the 99-cent store, and they're too tight on my calves. That's the way I stretch them out. I said, why are you shopping at the 99-cent store? You have $500,000 under your bed. He goes, I had to make the money last.
It's been said that one of the reasons it took so long to catch Whitey Bulger is that people were looking for a gangster, and Bulger, whether he liked it or not, had ceased to be one.
He said it was hard to keep up that mindset of a criminal, and that's part of the reason he came down to that garage. It was hard to stay on that edge, that criminal edge, after being on the lam as a regular citizen for 15 years.
The master manipulator gave credit to Catherine Gregg for keeping him crime-free, hoping it would mitigate her sentence. She's now serving 8 years for harboring a fugitive. On the long plane ride back to Boston, Bulger told his captors that he became obsessed with not getting caught and would do anything to avoid it, even if it meant obeying the law. Whitey Bulger's biggest fear, they said, was being discovered dead in his apartment, and he had a plan to avoid it.
If he became ill and knew he was on his deathbed, he'd go down to Arizona, crawl down the bottom of one of these mines and die and decompose and hope that we would never find him and still be looking for him forever.
Now, Armin Katayan on assignment for 60 Minutes.
Nick Saban is the most dominant head coach today in college football. Although his Alabama Crimson Tide lost their final two games last season, won in improbable fashion, Saban has his team ranked once again among the elite as he guns for his fourth national championship in 6 years. He is worshipped by his rabid fan base, feared by his rivals, who see Saban as an intense, tightly wound control freak who takes little or no pleasure in all of his success. As we first reported last fall, Saban granted 60 Minutes rare access inside his program over 8 months. What we learned is while the rest of college football may be chasing Nick Saban, Nick Saban's chasing something else. Perfection.
The chant is "Get Your Mind Right." It's the mantra of the man out front, the heartbeat of the Alabama Crimson Tide, head coach Nick Saban. His program has become the gold standard of college football. To get a sense of how Saban has driven Alabama to the top, we begin with an afternoon in early August. An energized Saban couldn't wait to get to his favorite part of the day.
All right, blow the horn, let's go.
To practice. A thunderstorm had forced his team indoors.
Top hat, set, go.
But it didn't dampen Saban's passion to teach his players the finer points of football.
I want you to step. We're not getting much out of this, guys, because you guys won't do this stuff right. Do it again. No. Bring it back. Do it again.
In demanding his players be as exacting as he is, Saban can be volcanic.
I've told you 3 times already today.
Why are you so tough on people?
Well, I don't know if that's fair that I'm really tough on people. We create a standard for how we want to do things. And everybody's got to buy into that standard, or you really can't have any team chemistry. You know, mediocre people don't like high achievers, and high achievers don't like mediocre people.
Saban doesn't miss anything. On this afternoon, a freshman caught Saban's eye.
Hey, Eddie!
Number 4, Eddie Jackson, who seemed lost.
You an offensive lineman or what?
Jackson, a defensive back, was stretching with the offensive lineman.
You got to buy him, Eddie!
Trying to master Alabama's complex schemes was too much, too soon for Jackson.
Hey, Eddie, it's kick support. It's cover 2. Why are you backing up? You're supposed to come and force the edge.
Jackson looked like he wanted to crawl into a hole.
Come on, Eddie.
All of Alabama's players have been there.
Oh, Vinny.
Safety Vinny Sinceri remembers the day he and a fellow defensive back forgot a play.
And he throws his hat, and it's a straw hat, and it's not really heavy. He's able to throw it like Zorro at us. I thought it was going to hit us and knock us out. And just starts yelling at us, and we're like, oh, we just got Saban.
Got Saban.
Yeah.
He messed up my hat.
But Saban's players have faith in their coach largely because of a revolutionary approach he designed years ago called the process. Ignore the scoreboard, Saban preached to his players. Don't worry about winning. Just focus on doing your job at the highest level, every single play, and the wins will follow.
The approach was to challenge the players to play every play in the game like it had a history and life of its own, and tried to take the other team out of the game and make it all about us in terms of what we did.
It's like jumping out of a plane without a chute.
Yeah.
I mean, in your business, what, we're not going to focus on winning?
Right, but it really is the simple way to do it, and it's the best way to do it.
Star quarterback A.J. McCarron was involved in the one play that epitomizes just how deeply the process has been programmed into Alabama's players. Late in the blowout win over Notre Dame in the 2013 championship game, McCarron and his center, Barrett Jones, called different plays at the line of scrimmage, both insisting they were right. A bizarre shoving match ensued on national TV. Saban loved it.
The game's probably won. And
well, it's 42-14.
They're still trying to get it right, which to me is the kind of pride in performance that you want in the players.
Can you see the critics saying, Come on, Coach, just take a breath, relax, enjoy the moment.
I can see people saying that, but we're still coaching. We're trying to get them to do it right. I don't ever want the players to relax in a game.
Saban urges his team to do things the right way all the time. So when this player arrived late for a meeting because he was busy taking out his earrings, it didn't go over well.
Number one thing, be on time. Because it shows you care. All you're telling me is your earrings are more important than your damn football.
Saban never lets up, no matter the stage.
Hey, way to catch the ball!
On a sweltering June day when he could have taken the afternoon off, Saban was instructing young campers as if he was preparing to play LSU.
All right, here we go, bro. Again, get outside.
Even the simple act of handing out camp certificates turned into a life lesson.
Come on, man. Shake hands.
Why is Saban such a perfectionist? The answer lies on another football field in a small West Virginia mining town. Here, Saban's father, Nick Sr., started a Pop Warner team called the Black Diamonds. Today, the Black Diamonds are still playing on the same field, only it's now named for Nick Sr., a local legend. Nick remembers how his father's long, demanding practices always ended on a hill in the back of the end zone.
And it was like a three-level hill, and it's almost straight up, and that was our conditioning. We'd have to sprint up that hill, and it was so dark, he couldn't tell whether you made it to the top. So there was a row of trees up there. You had to bring a leaf back to prove that you made it to the top.
Nick grew up in a coal camp with just 9 streets. His dad owned this service station down the road. Nick started working for him at age 11.
If we washed a car when I worked for him at the service station and it was not done exactly perfectly correctly, he would say, wash it again.
And you had a fear, as I understand, of certain cars.
The navy blue ones and black ones were really hard to keep the streaks out of. A single streak, you had to do the whole car over again.
Well, now we know where the attention to detail comes from.
That's where it comes from.
Nick thought he wanted to run a car dealership after playing football at Kent State. But while serving there as a graduate assistant coach in 1973, he told his dad that coaching was in his blood.
I said, I think this is really what I want to do. That was the last conversation we had, because he passed away the next weekend.
His dad was only 46. Saban began a nomadic coaching career, never staying in one place more than 5 years. After he won the 2003 national championship at LSU, Saban was lured to the NFL to coach the Miami Dolphins. As Miami struggled late in the 2006 season, the University of Alabama, a fading football power still living off the days of the great Bear Bryant, was searching for a new coach. Alabama made Saban its number one target. Saban uttered these words.
Well, then I guess I have to say it. I'm not going to be the Alabama coach.
Do you regret that, Nick, saying...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I...
You said flat out, I'm not going to Alabama.
I really, in the end, you know, it affected my integrity as a person by saying one thing and doing something else.
Today in Alabama, Saban is treated like a god. He now has his own statue outside the stadium, a tribute to his national titles. Alabama has made him the highest paid coach in the game. Dr. Robert Witt, Alabama's chancellor, approved the contract.
Nick Saban makes north of $5.5 million a year. Very simply, is he worth it to the University of Alabama?
Nick Saban's the best financial investment this university has ever made. We have made an investment that's been returned manyfold.
The best investment the University of Alabama has ever made?
I believe.
3 national championships in 5 years has translated into tens of millions of additional dollars for the athletic department and the university. At 62, Saban continues to coach as if his next paycheck is in doubt.
We can't go to the line on offense and stand there till the shot clock runs out, trying to figure out what the defense is going to do so we can call a play.
Saban's idea of relaxation during the season? Watch more film. If you think Saban needs to get a life, well, you're not alone. But in a profession that is a minefield for couples, he's been married to his grade school sweetheart, Terry, for 42 years.
What's the secret of you two staying together.
Besides winning?
Yeah, that helps.
That does help.
Together, they've been a powerful team. Never more so than in April 2011, when a monstrous tornado ripped through Tuscaloosa. This was the view from Saban's office. 65 people were killed.
It's the first time in 42 years I've ever seen him totally put football aside.
You know, I immediately called the team meeting and I said, look, guys, you know, we have to go serve the people who have always supported us.
This family has two little girls.
Terry and Nick's fund, Nick's Kids, has helped rebuild 15 homes destroyed by the tornado. It's another sign that Saban seems to have found the right fit in Tuscaloosa.
He appears more content. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's true, and I think I've heard the assistant coaches who have been with him for years say that he's mellowing a little bit, and yet outsiders will see him on the field or at practice and say, mellowing relative to what?
Come on, Eddie, we're running a route at top of the numbers. Come on!
Remember number four, Eddie Jackson, the poor defensive back who couldn't do anything right in August? Well, he stuck with it. And by late September, here he was, starting in an important game against Mississippi. He intercepted a pass and helped the Crimson Tide shut out Ole Miss.
How gratifying is that, to see that kind of growth?
That's really what I enjoy about all this, to see guys do that. But sometimes you invest the same time in another guy, and they don't make the progress, and that can be just as frustrating.
Saban and his players were tested last September in front of one of the most intimidating crowds in the country. A showdown at Texas A&M, the only school to beat Alabama the year before, against a magician named Johnny Manziel.
Look at this. He's still on his feet and heaves it deep. Oh, my gosh!
When Manziel and A&M raced to a 14-0 lead in a matter of minutes, Alabama didn't fold. The Tide methodically regrouped, did what they were taught, played the play, and ultimately prevailed in its biggest game of the season to date.
Touchdown, Alabama!
In the locker room afterward, the players' reward was not only victory, but something just as treasured.
You guys got everybody in the room?
Praise from the perfectionist.
This is a great win. It's a great win for our program. It's important. And we did a great job of competing in the game today. To get behind 14-0 on the road and show the resiliency to come back like we did, I'm so happy, 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 I can't tell you. And I'm so proud.
I'm Scott Pelley. We'll be back next week with the 47th season premiere of 60 Minutes.